It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we're going to hear what books we should read to cure what might ail us, from headaches to loneliness.
Before that, though, the government shutdown is far-reaching, and we're taking a look at some of the ways it's affecting our communities. Tomorrow, we'll hear how it's affecting the agriculture sector and food inspections.
Today, we're going to talk about its effect on scientific research. Thousands of researchers have been furloughed around the country, and don't try visiting the National Science Foundation's website. It's offline until funding resumes. Here with us to talk about how science funding is being affected is Kenneth Rudinger. He's a PhD graduate student in the University of Wisconsin-Madison's physics department. He's a member of the American Physical Society. We saw a piece he wrote in the journal Sentinel titled "Government Shutdown Threatens Scientific Research." Kenneth, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So you were worried before this shutdown about how it would affect research. How is it affecting scientific research in Wisconsin and around the country?
Oh, that's a great question. It's really having a pretty negative impact on research. I think there are a lot of good examples. So in Madison, there is the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, which is part of the university. And fortunately, it has enough funding at this point, even though there is a shutdown to run through December, but they outsource a lot of their lab work, such as complex DNA sequencing, which gets sent to a lab in California. Because of the shutdown, that has to go on hold until there are more funds in place. So that's one example. Another, the United States Geological Survey has a science center in Middleton, and they've stopped doing a lot of their data collection currently. This includes samples that they take to monitor water quality. So these are just a couple of sort of local examples. And a lot of good examples nationwide as well. So if you consider NASA, for example, they've furloughed 97% of their workforce of 18,000. What does this mean? Well, this means a lot of different research projects are now on hold. There is a forthcoming NASA launch to Mars is in danger of losing its launch window. This is the MAVEN spacecraft, or Mars Atmosphere and Volatile Evolution spacecraft. And the goal is to study the Martian atmosphere, understand why it's thin. This could have a fairly important impact for our understanding of climate, and you know, we may just lose that. Hopefully that doesn't happen. There's still some time left, but that's another example. There are a lot of examples with the National Institute of Health, National Science Foundation, Center for Disease Control, Department of Energy, National Labs. I can give you more specifics if you're interested, but there's a whole bunch of different things.
Thinking back to my high school chemistry, it's really hard to stop and start experiments as you roll along.
Yes.
It might just sound to me like, oh, it's just a couple of days or a couple of weeks. Does this disrupt research for a long term?
Oh, yeah. This absolutely can have a profound disrupting effect because, you know, you spend all this time just getting ready to shut down the lab. Then you're not in the lab doing the research. And then when it's time to start up again, there's the additional cost of getting all of the machines back online, getting all of your samples prepared again. So it definitely has, as you mentioned, you know, there is a non-trivial sort of startup cost just to doing these projects.
So some people might be wondering, do we need this federally funded research in the first place? Are we really losing that much? Can you make the case for federal funding of scientific research?
That's a great question, and absolutely. So I think there are a lot of really excellent examples of technologies that we benefit from every day from that we have because of the federal investment in research. So, for example, magnetic resonance imaging, MRIs. We have those because of research that scientists did just studying fundamental properties of the atom several decades ago. We have GPS technology. We have because of special and general relativity, it turns out. And these are things that, you know, we don't think about when we say, well, we should study certain aspects of science. And sometimes there are applied projects that we have a specific goal in mind, and sometimes we don't. And it turns out that we can get really really great benefits from those research projects as well. You know, beyond what we were expecting. There have been a lot of research has been done into the economic impact of scientific research, And depending on what economist you talk to, you get a number between 50 and 85% of the United States economic growth in the latter half of the 20th century and now going into the 21st century comes from investment in scientific research.
Well, we don't know how long this shutdown is going to last. Days, weeks, I don't know. What do you see as the impact if these if the scientific funding isn't there for a long period of time like that? What will the researchers you mentioned earlier be doing? How much will that affect their work?
That's a great question. That's going to, I think, really have, again, a very negative impact. So you're just going to have these research projects not getting done. What also is going to happen is grant proposals are not going to be reviewed. Right now, the National Science Foundation and the National Institute of Health, for example, are not reviewing or accepting grant proposals. So this means that there's money in the future that even people who are not federal employees themselves are not going to have access to for their research. This also has implications for hiring. When researchers want to hire graduate students or postdoctoral researchers, they need to know that there's some certainty in the funding so they can fund these researchers. This is particularly important for people who are not U.S. citizens, for whom, you know, if they can't get a job at a particular time in a particular lab, that this window of opportunity to have them come to the United States and have them contribute their knowledge and expertise to our scientific efforts may just be lost. So I think that these are, you know, really sort of profound impacts, and the longer it goes on, the worse off we will be.
You mentioned earlier the U.S. Geological Survey here in Wisconsin and the Great Lakes research that is being affected, and you mentioned there are some other examples you could get into. Can you give us a taste of what other specific kinds of research are off the table for today and maybe tomorrow too?
Sure. Absolutely. So the National Institute of Health, they are currently not accepting any more patients for clinical trials. So this is, you know, to do a variety of different sorts of medical testing to try new treatments for a variety of diseases, you know, such as cancer. There are, I believe, about 200 people a week that normally would start clinical trials with the NIH. And they're just not going to be getting this treatment now. We're just not going to be learning about, you know, are these good drugs? Are these good treatments? Are these things that can improve our quality of life? Are these things that can save people's lives? We're just not going to find out, you know, indefinitely. Hopefully it will be a short indefinitely.
So the piece go ahead.
Oh, no, sorry, continue.
The piece you wrote, I mentioned, was before the shutdown. We're in the middle of a shutdown now. If you had a chance to talk to folks in Congress, what would your message be for them on scientific funding and the shutdown?
I would just remind them of the profound impact that scientific funding has on all of us in terms of economic impact, in terms of quality of life, in terms of just expanding our horizons, expanding the breadth of our knowledge. And you know, I think I would give them these historical examples. I would ask them, you know, what could change your mind? What could convince you that scientific research is worth investing in? And you know, hopefully they would acknowledge at some point at some level there would be some benefits that we accrue from scientific research, and you know, hopefully I'd be able to convince them that. The way to do that is to fund scientific research.
All right, Kenneth, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Kenneth Rudinger. He's a PhD graduate student at UW-Madison in the physics department. He's a member of the American Physical Society.
And coming up, we'll check the headlines, and then we'll talk about bibliotherapy, the practice of curing ailments with books. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Well, how are you feeling today? Maybe hopeless, a bit lonely? Maybe you've got a headache or are suffering from the flu?
Well, before you rush out to the doctor or therapist, or maybe in addition to that visit, our next guest says there's an easier way to find some comfort from whatever ails you. a good novel, and she's happy to recommend the perfect book for you.
Susan Elderkin is here with us now. She's a writer, author, and bibliotherapist. She's the co-author of the new book, The Novel Cure, From Abandonment to Zestlessness, 751 Books to Cure What Ails You. Susan, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you. Good to be here.
Well, I wonder if we can start by getting a read on exactly what bibliotherapy is.
Well, bibliotherapy, as we see it, is the prescribing of books, and particularly fiction in our case, for life's ailments, be they physical or emotional or situational. I think we've all experienced a book that, if we read the right book at the right moment, has been transformative for us in some way, and our job is to try and find the right book for you at the right time in your life.
And what is that book for you? Do you remember a book that fit that bill?
Oh, a book that does it for me every time is, I don't know whether how big he is in the States, but the wonderful H.E. Bates, whose book The Darling Buds of May is a sort of 1950s classic from England. And there's not a cynical note in the entire work of H.E. Bates, and it's a great pick-me-up novel. I love it for its lovely, carefree vision of a bucolic English countryside existence, and it's I live in America now, and it's a great cure for nostalgia for me and for homesickness.
Hmm. And in general, we're not talking about self-help books here or medical books. You prescribe specifically with your co-author. You guys prescribe fiction. Why fiction?
Well, that's our new thing in a way. I mean, it's not that we're against self-help books. They do a good job, and they're an important part of taking responsibility for one's own health and happiness. But it's quite easy to find your own self-help book. It's quite easy to see on the cover what it's going to promise to do for you. And our idea is that literature, 2,000 years of literature, has some really amazing minds working on what it is to be alive. And they've written stories, authors throughout the centuries have written stories about people who have struggled with the same issues that we struggle with every day of our lives. And it's missing out on a huge opportunity and resource if we overlook this as a way to expand our knowledge of how to deal with certain situations, or you know our love life or our domestic life, our losing a job or starting a family. You know, there's somebody in literature who's been there and done it, and possibly found a way around the very problem that you're facing.
What do you think it is about reading a piece of fiction when you're feeling a particular way that's so prescriptive? Because in a way, it doesn't make sense that a book, just mere words on a page, could help you feel better.
Yeah, I mean, it's part of the magic of reading for me, and I've always been a big reader. I studied English at university, but I've always read since I was a child. And I mean, you know, on a basic level, there's something we escape into the world of the book. We kind of it's almost as if our reality has become suspended for that time, that we're totally caught up and transported. So that has a, for me anyway, that has a kind of meditative effect on my mind. And the rhythm of the words, these things all work on us, as well as the ideas in there. So I think books can work on you in many different levels. You know, it's not just the story, it's not just what the character did and what they say. It's the very act of being transported in that way. It's the kind of break from the worries of being, you know, of doing whatever we're doing before we were reading, and whilst you're reading, you're kind of, I don't know, you're in another place, and you're experiencing another sort of mindset in a way.
And do you think it lasts? Can reading a book have a lasting effect? You get through it, and you feel somehow in a different place than you felt when you began?
Definitely, yes, definitely. I think, I mean, also one can return to books which have been curative in a way. I mean, I remember reading Anna Karenina when I was about 22 and just sort of being inspired by this brave, heroic woman who kind of was so animated and had such a love for life. And I think, you know, really inspired my own approach to living. And now I read it now. I'm in my 40s now. It has a slightly different effect on me now. I'm more sobered by, you know, the ending of the novel. I don't want to say too much about it, but, you know, you bring your richness of experience of life to the novel, and it makes me think about makes me think about relationships and complex things in a very different way. But yes, I think that stayed with me my entire life. And the interesting thing is that the nature of that relationship with that book has changed subtly over time. That happens with the really great books.
And you don't distinguish between physical stuff and emotional stuff in the book anyway. Is that tongue-in-cheek, though? Can a book really help you with a broken leg?
Well, we have a bit of fun with the physical ailments. I mean, obviously, I was just joking with my husband because he's a doctor. He's a real doctor. And, you know, if you've got appendicitis, you need to go to the doctor and you need to have it removed. And, there's a limit to how much we can help with that. But you know, appendicitis is actually in our book, and we prescribe the really wonderful children's book, Madeline, by Benelmans. And it's a wonderful story. Lots of children's books are great bibliotherapy for adults, actually. And it's a wonderful story about a little girl who goes into hospital for appendicitis. And it's, you know, first of all, a terrible thing. But, of course, she gets lots of sweets. She gets lots of presents. And after a while, all of her peers from her orphanage want to have their appendix out as well. And so, you know, actually, that probably is quite a nice thing to read when you're in the hospital with appendicitis, to look on the bright side of it.
Yeah, you're pretty comprehensive in this book. I stumbled across an entry for hemorrhoids. There's a book that you recommend reading for hemorrhoids.
Yeah, well, that's a bit of a walking cure. I think one of the things which, we work on different levels in the book. Sometimes it's, you know, we prescribe with the opposite thing. So, like with the cynicism, when you're feeling cynical about life, we give you a book without any cynicism in it. And sometimes we're actually encouraging you to get up and do the same as the person in this book. And Ian Sinclair's book, Downriver, is the narrator of that book just walks and walks and walks around London. And our idea is that increasing the circulation will probably improve your health generally, but also, if after a while your feet will hurt so much that it'll take your mind off pains in other parts of your body.
Which shall not be named. So about depression, now that's something that I can imagine a lot of writers themselves have struggled with, and it's a theme in a lot of novels. What do you recommend for depression?
Well, we divide depression into two parts, really, because it's obviously there's a sliding scale. You can be a little bit blue or you can be seriously depressed. And a little bit blue, we prescribe pick-me-up books. We have got fried green tomatoes at the Whistle Stop Cafe, for instance, or Cold Comfort Farm by Stella Gibbons. You know, these are light and brightening reads. But for the seriously depressed, it's a very different thing that's required, we found. I mean, we've worked with as bibliotherapists with patients with severe depression, and it seems that people don't really, they want to know that they're not alone. They want to know that, you know, they're not going crazy, and they want to know of other people who have been in their predicament. And we prescribe The Bell Jar by Sylvia Plath. We prescribe The Unbearable Lightness of Being. Betty Blue by Grand Central Station, I Sat Down and Wept, I think is in there, by Elizabeth Smart. These are books written often by authors who have experienced depression themselves and know really what it's like.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that because, I don't know, reading The Bell Jar, this is an author who committed suicide. Do you really want to read that when you're already depressed?
Well, the way we see it is Sylvia Plath didn't have the advantage of having a Sylvia Plath novel to read. I mean, this is in a way, I mean, it is a very serious thing that she did commit suicide. But for those who have come after her, I love to think of it as her helping people from beyond the grave. I mean, I know definitely of at least one person that I've worked with who was hugely helped by that book, because it's like, my God, this is exactly what I've gone through. This is exactly where I'm at. And you know, Sylvia Plath may not have had a novel like that to go to. I'm not saying that, you know, she necessarily would have been saved by it, but, you know, possibly, who knows? And I think one can't underestimate the importance of not feeling alone with one's illness.
Well, I want to see if we can leave our listeners with one more. We're running short of time, a little less than a minute here, but what do you prescribe for anxiety, which is another well-known malady of our time?
Well, a couple of things I would suggest for that. There's a beautiful book called The Man Who Planted Trees by Jean Giono, which is a very slim little novel. It won't take very long to read, and if you're feeling anxious about things, you know, you don't want to be faced with a great big fat book. And it's about a man who plants acorns in the ground, and he has a labor of love over it, and he spends his evenings sorting the acorns into piles of good and bad, and the daytime planting them. And, of course, great forests grow up in the wake. So it's about really encouraging you to just breathe slowly, calm down, and to look at things in a very simple new way. You know, our lives are filled with lots and lots of complexities these days, and sometimes we just need to step aside from that and just take one acorn at a time.
All right. Well, Susan, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
It's been fun to be here. Thank you for having me.
We've been talking to Susan Elderkin, the co-author of the book The Novel Cure, From Abandonment to Zestlessness, 751 Books to Cure What Ails You.
If you have a book that you turn to when you're down, when you're sick, let us know on the Central Time Facebook page. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll continue our Hidden Wisconsin series by talking with one of Milwaukee's most popular cab drivers.
And we'll also be talking with comedian, author, and resident expert for The Daily Show, John Hodgman. He'll be in Madison this weekend for a comedy show at the Barrymore.
And we'll discuss the president and the pipeline and the campaign to make the Keystone XL the test of President Obama's resolve on climate change.
All that coming up tomorrow here on Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Just about every bar in Wisconsin can be considered a Packers bar, but Packers bars aren't just found in Wisconsin.
When the Packers step onto the field this weekend, fans of the green and gold in New York City will crowd into a local bar to cheer on their favorite team. Producer Sean Conley has the story in this episode of Wisconsin Life.
When you step into a bar in New York City, there's one song you don't typically expect to hear.
I mean, it's a Greenwich Village bar, but with an extremely strong Wisconsin team.
Patrick Daly is the owner of the Kettle of Fish, a historic bar in Manhattan's Greenwich Village.
And then in the mid-50s, the beat started coming into town. Ginsberg, Kerouac, Gregory Corso all hung out at the Kettle.
Patrick began working in the bar in the mid-80s. And while he has called New York home for decades, he's a true fan of the green and gold.
Packer blood in the family. Born and raised a Packer fan, of course. My folks are from East and West De Pere. My mom from East, my dad from West.
So when Patrick bought the Kettle in 1998, each Sunday, he'd be watching the game.
In the beginning, I watched games, and then I'd be screaming at the TV by myself.
With the help of a few patrons, the word spread. And before long, Patrick, along with his partner Adrian, were surrounded by Packer fans every Sunday.
Just built, and it wasn't meant to do that. I was just a Packer fan.
But today, Google Packer Bar NYC, and Kettle of Fish is the first hit you'll find, which draws in a lot of Wisconsinites.
My name is Jake. I grew up in Green Bay, Wisconsin. Went to school out of state, and then when I graduated in 08, I moved to New York. So a buddy of mine and I went to Kettle of Fish, and when I got there immediately, it just looked like and felt like a place that would have existed in Green Bay or Wisconsin.
All the people that I've ever brought there that aren't Packer fans never think it's going to be that intense.
Annie Kiefer is another Green Bay native who now calls New York City home.
Everybody in the bar watches every play, talks about every down and every call.
Again, here's the bar owner, Patrick.
I mean, it's great. People socialize before the game. People socialize a bit during. But really, during the game, everybody's paying attention. Everybody's watching the game.
And while taking in a Packer game at the Kettle of Fish is very much about watching football, for us far from home Sconnies, it's about more than that. Here's another Green Bay native turned New Yorker, Ben Kopisch.
Everyone that I know from Green Bay or northeastern Wisconsin, or even Wisconsin or the Midwest in like a wider sense, they have such an appreciation for where they're from. I love telling people that I'm from Green Bay. Like, I don't want to give up my Wisconsin license. I have a New York ID, but I have a Wisconsin driver's license because it still says Green Bay on there. Whether that's a little cockamamie or whatever, I don't care. I think that's one of the best eccentricities you could have.
And what better way to celebrate where you're from than by watching your home team with new friends and old right in the middle of the world's greatest melting pot.
Thanks to Sean Connolly for that piece. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. You can find more information at wisconsinlife.org.
This is Central Time. College football has grown into much more than a rallying point for school spirit or extracurricular pastime.
Last year, the national championship drew a television crowd second only to the Super Bowl, and the average budget for a top 10 school is now $80 million a year.
College football may be a booming industry, but it's not without some consequences. Investigative journalists Jeff Benedict and Armin Katayan recently co-authored a comprehensive behind-the-scenes look at the college sport in their new book, It's the System: The Glory and Scandal of Big-Time College Football. Armin Katayan joins us now to discuss their findings. He's a CBS News correspondent based in New York, 11-time Emmy winner. Armin, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure.
How did college football grow into such a big, popular, big-money game that it is today?
Well, I think if you had to point to one aspect of it, or two aspects of it, is, first of all, it's a tremendous spectacle, and it has great passion and loyalty among the fan base, and certainly Wisconsin would qualify in that category right at the top of the list. But I think the second thing, and probably the more important thing in the last 4 or 5 years, really has been the absolute infusion of multiples of millions and really billions of dollars into the game, primarily into the television contracts, both the national contracts that ESPN and Fox and CBS and ABC are signing, but I think even more importantly, ESPN's huge investment in the game, and particularly, you know, $600 million a year beginning next season to televise a series of postseason games, but primarily $413 million of that $600 for three games, the two semifinal games and the final game of the new national championship.
Well, in your book, you tell a lot of stories and you dig into a lot of scandals there. And reading through, I got an overarching picture, a feeling of pressure. All this money, the pressure from alumni to succeed at every level, the athletic directors, the NCAA as a whole, the coaches, the players, there's all this pressure, and it seems like it's just waiting for cracks and scandals to happen. Is that the feeling you get when you start digging into these stories?
I think that's a very good word, is that the thing that Jeff and I really tried to do was to kind of pull the curtain back on the mega programs and to give the average fan or the avid fan or the rabid fan a better idea of really all the machinery that goes into these mega programs and each aspect of it, where each chapter sort of takes one part of the system, which we always saw as a machine. And if you take each of those component parts, there's pressure within that component part. The pressure of an athletic director, like, say, David Brandon at the University of Michigan, to be able to generate $90 million a year to fund his entire athletic department, that $90 million coming from football. The pressure of under a college coach, let's say Mike Leach out at Washington State now, and what he has to do, or the university, which is making an enormous investment in not only Mike's $2 million a year salary, but an $80 million expansion of their stadium and their football facilities. The pressure that hostesses feel when they're recruiting these athletes, their place within the system. The pressure that tutors are under, and the relationships that they have with athletes, which, as we document in the book, the sexual tension and sometimes sexual assaults that result from this unusual relationship that a lot of tutors find themselves in with the athletes. So unquestionably, and then let me just to finish that, if there is one thing that came out of this book from my mind is the enormous pressure. If you think in terms of an inverted pyramid, the tip of that pyramid is placed right in the backs of 18 to 22-year-old kids. Because the entire pyramid, all the money, all the coaching salaries, all the branding that football is being used for by universities is placed right in the middle of the backs of these kids. And there's more pressure than ever on them to perform, and there's more pressure on them right now, I think, in the academic side of things and certainly on the athletic side of things.
Let's follow that thread with those student athletes. And you mentioned that the term is used often more derisively than otherwise. Let's start with playing injured. How much pressure is there for a coach to get that player to play hurt, regardless maybe of short and long-term risks?
I think one of the things that we did was, and Jeff and I wanted to do a lot of our own independent reporting, we documented through the use of other reporters who worked with us and researchers that last year in the top eight BCS conferences and the two major independents, meaning Notre Dame and BYU, that there were 282 season-ending injuries in big-time college football last year. That's a staggering number. And even more interestingly, 35% of those injuries, of those 282, happened this month, in the month of October, because you're at the end of a very difficult summer conditioning session, a very intense training camp. Then you start to play games, some of them lesser opponents, but now teams are moving into their conference play. So this weekend and then the next really four weekends, you're going to see far more injuries, I think, in college football than you'll see at any other time of the year. And that places pressure on the coaches to keep these kids in the lineup, because look what's already happened just in this first month of the season. Paul Pasqualoni of UConn was fired after four games, 0-4 start. Lane Kiffin was removed after losing seven of his last 11 games at USC. The pressure on these coaches is doing anything but decreasing. And that means that pressure filters down, just like that pyramid. That pressure filters down onto the backs of these kids. And the need for them to play, the star player to get on the field, to maybe ignore that injury that he could use to take another week to recover and to go out and play on Saturday, because the win is so important to either stay in the hunt for a conference championship or for a national championship.
And what happens to the players who are injured and can't play anymore? They're off the TV. Where do they go then?
Well, I think that's one of the real sad parts of the system is that, you know, many of them are discarded. You know, these scholarships now are year to year. They're not 4-year grants. They're granted a scholarship or given a scholarship that's renewable year by year. So athletes who are injured, who are no longer of value to a football team, are often either told that they're no longer wanted and really it would be good for them to transfer, or if they're injured, they're given medical waivers so that that scholarship becomes available to the next recruit. So, you know, the system can be very cold-blooded. And one of the things we tried to do in the book, and I think we were very successful at it, is to get people who have lived inside this system and have been a part and parcel of it to speak on the record about their experiences. So whether it was a director of football operations at Texas who dubbed himself the janitor, or whether it was, Lacey Pearl Earps, who was the hostess at Tennessee who got caught up in a scandal at Tennessee, or whether it's Teresa Brackle, who was a tutor at Missouri who got caught up in a sexual assault down there, or what it's like to go behind the scenes with Game Day and Chris Fowler and the people that put that together. We did not want to use unnamed sources, and we used very, very few of them. And I think that's one of the reasons this book has really captured people's attention and has received such strong reviews is that it's not Armin and Jeff telling you. It's people that Armin and Jeff interviewed, of which there were more than 500 people that we interviewed, outlining their experiences. And I think that's what makes this book unique.
We're talking to Armin Katayan. He's a CBS News correspondent, co-author of The System, The Glory and Scandal of College Football.
And now you can join in. Are you a fan of college football? Do you worry about the money involved and some of the issues that our guest is talking about right now? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or send your email to talk@wpr.org.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're back now with Armin Katayan, and we're talking about his new book, The System, The Glory and Scandal of College Football.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, with your questions about college football, your worries about it, scandals you'd like to ask about, 800-642-1234. Armin, we'll get to calls in just a minute, but first, you mentioned a couple times the hostesses, and I want to get into that a little more. There's one of the pressures we talked about earlier is recruiting and trying to compete with your rivals and get the best players out of high school. Where do these hostesses fit into that effort?
Well, I think they fit in right at the front of the line, Rob. They're, you know, they're kind of the secret weapons of a lot of these schools, particularly in the South and the SEC, and where you have 17 or 18-year-old boys being recruited and enticed by 21 and 22-year-old girls, principally over social media now. Well, actually, to back up, the hostesses are really the first face that a high school recruit will see when they come on campus. They're very pretty. They're smart. They've got terrific personalities, or they wouldn't be part of the hostess program. They know the school very well, and there's unquestionably, at times with the recruits and the hostesses, there is an intimation that, certainly a flirtation, but more so an intimation that if you come here, the possibility exists that we could have a relationship together. And then that is fostered, which is really a change in the last few years over the social media networks, Facebook or Skype, particularly Skype, where now, in the case of the young woman that we profiled at Tennessee, she would be on Skype with some of these recruits, the top recruits, until 3 or 4 in the morning, talking about, you know, who knows what at that hour of the night. But they are absolutely critical. What was interesting in Lacey's case was she was nicknamed the closer at Tennessee because of her ability to get these top recruits to commit, one of them which was Bryce Brown, who was the top recruit in the country. Lacey told us that she never slept with one of these recruits, but she said unquestionably she would use, you know, the sexual tension and the intimation that the possibility existed that if they did come to the school, that relationship was possible. So it's kind of an unseen side of big-time college football, but it's an incredibly important side.
And this was at Tennessee. You said this is not the only school that does something like this.
Oh, no. I mean, you know, the SEC, whether it's the Bama Bells or the Orange Pride of Tennessee, or there's, you know, the same similar circumstances at Florida. You know, the Big Ten in cases have hostess programs. You know, they're across the Angels are at the University of Texas. It's across the country, and primarily, you know, in the mega programs where all things being equal, facilities, stadium size, coaching staff, academic centers, things of that nature. Let's face it, a 17-year-old boy, his many ways, his fantasy is having a relationship with a college girl. He comes there for the weekend, he's wined and dined, you know, and I'm putting quotes around that, but he's certainly made to feel very special. And one of the people that's doing that, the primary person that's doing that, is this beautiful college girl whose job is to make this kid feel like he's the greatest thing on the face of the earth. So, it's part and parcel of these programs. They're portrayed as tour guides and escorts, meaning they show the kids around campus. But in reality, and I think that's one of the really the best chapters of the book, is it's incredible insight into not only what Lacey was doing, but just as importantly, what happened to her once there was a investigation at Tennessee and her name popped up as part of a scandal. She was thrown under the bus by Lane Kiffin, who was then the head coach there. And that also tells you something about the system.
Let's go to the phones now. We've got Jeffrey on the line in Oshkosh. Jeffrey, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm curious how often the misconduct or ethical lapses by top campus administrators who know of or approve of this misconduct, how often are they disciplined or terminated?
Well, I think that really depends on a couple of things. One is the NCAA's enforcement staff, which has been, frankly, on the run lately because of some situations that ethical breaches they found themselves in at involving an investigation of the University of Miami. And I think two is how open is a university to investigating itself and getting to the bottom of potential scandal. And I think you find more often than not, athletic departments are willing to look the other way. Because let's face it, college football programs have become, you know, the face of a university. Unquestionably, I could name, and Wisconsin's at the, on that list as well. Mm-hmm. Alabama, I happen to be in Tuscaloosa right now working on a piece about Nick Saban. Nick Saban's effect at the University of Alabama has been extraordinary on the change of the student applications that are here. A much different student is now applying. 54% of their students are now from out of state, which has a tremendous impact on the bottom line of the university. They have taken the athletic department revenues from about $52 million to north of $90 million in the last couple of years. So these university football programs are no longer just football programs. They are the welcome mat or the front porch of a university. And I think Wisconsin certainly falls into that category. And when you have that at stake, how willing are you to look at the transgressions of people within the single most important department, in many cases, at a university? And that takes a strong-willed president to do something like that. And in the case of, you could look at Ohio State, you know, that university got caught up in a pretty big scandal because they believed their head coach when he said to them, you know, I know nothing about this Tattoogate scandal.
In our last minute or so, Armin, I want to ask you a general question. You've told a lot of stories, a lot that we won't even get to today. Do you think that college football is corrupting the mission of our universities and colleges around the country?
Wow. I don't know if it's corrupting it. It's certainly affecting it. I think you can no longer call these athletes student athletes. I think we show now that they're athlete students. They're spending more time in football-related activities, 41-plus hours a week, than they are in educational activities. So that's like 38 hours a week. When they become, you know, the brands of the university, you know, the mission gets skewed. And frankly, with all this money pouring in this national playoff on the horizon and all the problems that college football has had in the last even 6 months, I can't remember one college president who has stood up and said, look, this cannot continue. We have to do something to put this train, this runaway train, back on the tracks. And until they do that, I'm not really sure where this is headed. And I would argue that I don't think people like Mark Emmert at the NCAA or any of the other power brokers in this sport, whether it be Jim Delaney in the Big Ten or Mike Slide, the commissioner of the SEC, knows where it's headed.
Armin, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate it. That was Armin Katayan, CBS News correspondent, co-author of The System, The Glory and Scandal of College Football.
Next is the news, and then we'll speak with an expert on Wisconsin's options for the Affordable Care Act. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.